This is Bob Bosselman, recorded at his home at Offley Hay, near Eccleshall in Staffordshire, by Chris Alden Lee on the 9th of September 2010. Bob Bosselman, Part 1.
Bob Bosselman. I was born in August 1945 in China.
Why?
That was a silly question, because, to tell you a silly story, I got a place to go to Cambridge University to read veterinary science, and I was looking for someone to pay for it. And Pfizer, an American drug company, were looking to give scholarships. In those days, £1,000 a year, which was huge sums of money. A 16-page application form, which I filled in quite happily. There were 30 places. There were about 3,500 of us after these scholarships. Got through the first round of interviews, and we were told then there were 60 people after 30 places. The interview was going to last exactly 55 minutes, the final interview, and there were going to be three guys the other interviewing us. So you had a 1-in-2 chance. Saw the clock getting to about 50 minutes. I thought, I've cracked this. The interview's going well. And the chairman, who was a big Texican, and this was when the Cultural Revolution was going on in China, he goes through my application forms and suddenly shouts, "Mr. Bosselman," he says, "why was you born in China?" Like a prat, I said, "because my mother was there at the time." Well, I lost the interview and I got 4 and 6, which is my underground fare.
Why was your mother there at the time?
Because my mother's English, my father's German. My father was, even though German, was violently anti-Nazi. And my parents, it's a wonderful history, my parents were married in Holland the day the Nazis invaded Holland. And the only way they could get out was going across the Trans-Siberian Railway into China, and that's where my parents lived for the war.
And were you there for a long time?
No, I came back when I was 2 years old.
How was the rest of the childhood?
I was brought up in London, strange enough. Well, not strange enough. Being a country vet now, it is rather strange, but good, yeah.
Private education? Public
school? Private education, yes, boarding school. First of all down in Eastbourne and then in Bradfield in Reading.
And what was your father's career when he re-established himself back here?
We had a family business, but my mother's family had a business which was importing, exporting spices from China.
Oh, really? Yes.
We are the biggest importer of, strangely enough, eiderdown, feathers and rhubarb leaves and various other strange things.
What was your first inkling that you might end up being a vet?
Again, in the late 1960s, it was slightly elitist to go to universities. I'm one of four. My sister was a secretary. My brother joined the family firm. I didn't want to do it in the family firm. I wanted to farm. I've no idea why I wanted to farm, but I always wanted to farm, even though I was brought up in London. And so my younger brother wanted to be an accountant from a very early age. So my parents, my mother in particular, thought it would be wonderful if one of the kids went to university. And if they're going to go to university, they should really go to Oxford, Cambridge. That was my mother's absolute clue. So in those days, you could apply for Oxford, Cambridge and all the other universities. So I applied for Oxford, was offered a place to read microbiology. Went to Cambridge with view to reading zoology. Met a most wonderful man called Mark Pryor, who was a tutor, who was a zoologist. And he interviewed me and said, "Yes, I'm going to give you a place, but why do you want to read zoology?" Don't really know.
Don't know, sir.
Don't know, sir. And he was a lovely man. He talked about it and he said, "Have you ever thought about being a vet?" And it was exactly like St. Paul going to Damascus. No sooner you said it, it was so obvious that's what I was looking for. But I'd had no contact with a vet at home or anything at all. And that was it. And I came back from that, said to Mum, "I'm going to Cambridge and I'm going to be a vet."
And you became a vet?
Yes.
And your first job after Cambridge was where?
In Lechlade, in the Cotswold.
Country vet?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So what was your first brush or thinking about the Antarctic then? When did you first... What's your earliest memory of even knowing it exists?
Reading my aunt, who I've never met, my mother's sister's copy of Scott's Tragic Trip to the Antarctic. And I aged about 12 or 13. And I just thought, even then, I have got to go there. I've absolutely no idea why. I just read it, and it just... that was it.
So, was your thinking about going to the Antarctic and your thinking about being a vet divergent thoughts or convergent thoughts?
No, totally. No, at the time, they weren't in the vaguely connected. The only thing is, Andrew Bellars, who was the vet before I went, he was there about 3 years before me. He came back from the Antarctic in my final year at Cambridge. So I did meet Andrew.
So you met him then?
And had a vague connection, yes. Okay. And the three vets who've been with Bass have all been connected with Cambridge.
Was Andrew Bellars a sort of inspiration? Did he start a train of thought rolling?
No, he just made me think there was an opportunity. Yeah, well, yeah, from that point of view, yes.
Yeah. So how did you get to go? How did you apply?
I went into practice. I'd been in practice for a couple of years, and in those days, most of us would move jobs after a couple of years. You'd got the experience you could out of the practice, and it was time to move on to somewhere else, get some more experience. And at that stage, I wrote to Bass, and in my modest way, said, "I'm a great bloke, and you need me." And I'm
so there was no advert? You didn't respond to an
advert? No, absolutely not.
This would be about 1974 or so.
72. Okay. I was very fortunate in that this condition called footlurk had broken out about a fortnight before I applied. So that was ideal.
Were you a world expert on footlurk at that point? No.
No one knew what footlurk was, so, you know, that...
So, we'll come to that in a moment. So, you wrote a letter and at some point you got a reply...
Yep.
Saying?
Come for an interview with Eric Salmon. Full stop. Went down for an interview. And in those days, the interviews with Eric Salmon and Bill Sloman. And it was almost like the Boy Scouts. It was not a difficult interview. Well, far as I was concerned, I was very fortunate. Going back some, when I hadn't a clue what I wanted to do in a career, my father, when I was about 17, 18, yeah, before I went to university, made me go to an awful lot of interviews with people who were vaguely connected with agricultural farming. And I wasn't looking for jobs, I was looking for a career, a future career. And it made me, as a youngster, very, very confident at interviews. So the interview with Eric and Bill was, to me, extremely relaxed. It was almost as if the job was mine, let's talk. And it was lovely.
This is the common response.
I'm sure it is, yes. It is.
Did you at any time think you were being psyched out or sussed out psychologically?
No, not in the slightest, no.
Do you think you might, in retrospect, perhaps, were they? Or?
Because I don't really like then, but it was just so unbelievably successful that, yeah, it's got to work. Having got my place and going on a little bit, because I was living in Cambridge anyway, and in those days Bass was not in Cambridge, but the Bass headquarters right next door to the Cambridge Vet School, I don't know if you know that. So I was at the vet school, and Sylvia and Fuchs lived at Cambridge, and there was quite a few connections there. And so I was working really just before I went with both the vet school and SPRI, Scott Perth Research Institute, and they had a wonderful seminar of Antarctic doctors or polar doctors, and there was a wonderful session on psychology, and a New Zealander stood up and he gave his paper, which was basically he started off with psychology of prisoners and then he moved off to Antarctic people because they were just as isolated but a damn sight nicer people to work with. And then, and I don't think it's right or wrong, I've never looked it up, there was a marvellous guy, a Frenchman, who described their psychological test for people going to the Antarctic. And it was very, very good and quite in depth. And he's about to sit down, and he got the most tremendous reception. And he's about to sit down, he just suddenly said, "There is one problem. At the moment," and this would be 1972, "there have been only 7 suicides in the Antarctic. 6 of those have been French doctors."
Okay, so you were destined to go. You were told you were going to go at some point in 72.
Yes.
And then there was a bit of a gap, wasn't there? So what happened next? Before you went, I mean?
No, the gap about 4 or 5 months.
Yes. Was that training period for you? Or?
Yes, it was an opportunity. Because, I mean, I was basically employed as a GA, general assistant. And the GAs going to Stonington all had other skills. Most of them were climbers. So, I mean, I was basically going as a GA to support, GA to support a scientist. So it just gave me an opportunity to read up anything I could on any veterinary condition, any medical condition, what the heck was might be likely to cause his foot lurk condition.
Did you get any health and safety training, or crevasse rescue training?
No.
No. Even in 72?
No.
73?
No. Okay. We did when we got to Stonington.
Right.
But no.
Okay. So let's talk a bit about foot lurk, because it's come up twice and it is a key moment in your career.
Yes.
Because you clearly... Reading your papers, you've clearly done some work on foot lurk before you got there.
It was cured before I went there.
It was
because
cured.
I asked for material to be sent back. That came back on the ship. The ship that came back in 72. We'd come back about March 72, and I went out in November 72. So we had quite a lot of histological material from stuff, which I was then looking at, and that spent quite a lot of time. And that proved to be a ringworm. Very unusual situation.
Let's talk a bit about it, because, first of all, the name, it doesn't sound very biological to me, is it?
You know no, it isn't. Lurk is a FIDS term for, you know, lurking about, just kind of vaguely wandering around with no direction. It was just one of these slang words that went in there. And the strange thing about foot lurk, it was very, very interesting, actually. It broke out on exactly the same day at Stonington, Adelaide and Argentine Islands. So how can a condition break out on exactly the same day on three bases? What are they? 300-400 miles apart?
And what was the condition?
An ulceration of the skin at the margin between the pad, the foot pad and the skin. So the pad was ulcerating so that the dogs were extremely lame and unable to work. And that was the very, very serious concern, especially at Stonington.
So you had to unravel the mystery of what was the cause?
Yes.
And did you find it?
Yes, because if you work back, all the dogs that were affected 17 days before had been hauling dead seal up the beach at Stonington. So that was a connection, and that's why... It appeared to be breakout on three different bases, but that was the common denominator. And then working back from that, looking at the material we had, which was, as I say, post-mortem material that was sent to me, turned out to be a ringworm. There are three types of ringworm, and this was almost definitely a thing called trichophyton, which is the commonest one in dogs. And going back through history, it looked as if the beach was... the actual beach was exposed at Stonington for the first time in 1971, which is when this 71, 72, when this broke up.
This is by thaw.
Sorry?
By a thawing snow.
Thawing, yes. Mm. Since 1947, when Finn Ronnie was there. And Finn Ronnie definitely had ringworm in his dogs. And it appears that it stayed there, dormant under the ice.
Was it curable?
Yes, and that's why I sent the stuff down before I got there, and it was all cleared, sorted, before I got even left Cambridge to go down to the Antarctic.
So did you have to concoct something to send, or was it a standard veterinary?
I use a stuff called Netrosila, made by Bayer. It's no longer available. It's a liquid. You just dip the feet in it. A standard veterinary preparation was then.
Okay, and then you got there.
But so the good news was that I was employed to get rid of it, got rid of it before I even left Cambridge, but the contract had been signed.
But when you got there, you still carried on doing some work, didn't you, on the dog's feet?
I was actually hoping to see this, and I never ever saw it, but I looked at various different skin conditions in dogs, but never found... I mean, I was looking for the ringworm, I was looking for all sorts of things, and never came across it.
Was there any possible zoonosis, any way a man could catch this?
Theoretically, yes. In practice, it didn't happen.
Okay. Would that again be because of the cold temperatures?
When I don't know is the answer to that question. You've got a fairly close contact for them to spread it. Every species, so man has his own types of ringworm, dog has his own type, but they usually do cross-infect. But in that we didn't know which variety it was, we don't know if it's one that was easily, you know, to cross-infect or not. So I don't know the answer to that question, unfortunately.
Yes, yeah, so presumably your stakes were quite high, having solved the problem without it actually stepping foot on the ship, let alone being to the Antarctic.
My stakes were high?
Yeah.
In what respect?
Your reputation was high?
Well, yes and no, but the awful thing was that I was the first vet, I am the only vet of any nation, who spent a year in the Antarctic. A year. We've had two British vets who've been there for the summer. So then suddenly you've got all these questions about, you know, what are you going to do? And in those days, especially the at Stonington, Adelaide, which were very much doggy bases, all your conversation was about dogs. So what else can you do? And then it came out that, you know, part of our course is that we have to do meat inspection, and therefore they were expecting fresh meat whenever I was on cook. And, you know, it's all that sort of daft sort of things.
Let's talk about the trip down then. So you went in November of 72.
Yes.
On which ship?
Bransfield.
Directly to Stanley, or did you? All places on the way.
Montevideo.
In the usual way.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And unusually, you actually knew which base you were going to before you got to Stanley.
Yes.
And that was because that was a big dog base by the time.
One of the things to do then, unfortunately, was Halley Bay had dogs, and all the dogs. Fuchs had said that all the dogs would come out of Halley Bay, so one of the decisions I had to make was which dogs were going to be put down at Halley Bay and which dogs were going to go on. And the vast majority of dogs left Adelaide as well, so they were all going to be concentrated at Stonington. And as a new boy, that was one of my jobs, was to persuade everybody else that was the right decision, that which dogs were going to go and which dogs were going to be put down.
You must have met resistance.
A huge amount, especially at Halley Bay, yes.
Talk me through that.
Well, it's always very difficult, isn't it, when these guys have been there for 2 years. The feeling is electric about your own dogs. You're incredibly protective of them. And a new guy's going to come down, especially at Halley Bay, and put a lot of dogs down. It was not a very cheerful time. I hope I got away with it. I hope I didn't upset many people, or too many people, because it was an inevitable decision. It had to be done, and there was not room at Marguerite Bay for all the dogs.
And the dogs could not come back out of the Antarctic? Would that have been cruel?
I think so, yes. Moving on dramatically, when I came back, some time after came back, it was then Sir Vivian Fuchs retired and Dick Laws had taken over. And the decision was made to get rid of all the dogs. And there was a lot of pressure to bring dogs back here. But in fact, 90% of us who worked down there didn't want that to happen. The dogs are not domestic dogs. Mm. They live in a wonderful environment. They love working. They're wonderful dogs to work with, but we wouldn't have liked to see. If the odd person brought the odd pet back, it would have been all right, but to bring a load of dogs back to try and rehome in a domestic situation was not an option.
How did you choose? What criteria do you remember using to decide which dog should survive?
Sadly, first of all, age, and second of all, sex. I mean, politically incorrect, but older dogs, the roughly dogs over eight, most of them had to be put down because they were too old and arthritic at that stage. So, you know, in a decision like that, anything over six was, unless it was an extremely good dog, was put down. We required many, many more dogs than bitches, so a lot more bitches were put down than dogs. There were a couple of nervous dogs, I can't remember the names, what we called lurky dogs, and they, again, were very difficult to handle and to work with, so it was that sort of decision that was made.
How was that for a young vet who'd just been trained to look after animals, to nurture them, and then here you were, one of your...
Yeah, well, you say that, but unfortunately part of our job is to euthanize animals and put them down. And if you're working in farm practice, I'm now, you know you're looking after animals in order to slaughter them for human consumption. Well, it's slightly different on domestic pets, yeah. But we still have to put a lot of animals down.
But that, you know that now, but you were a young...
I've been going for a couple of years, and it's never easy, but you do get hardened to it. It was just one of those decisions you have to make.
Were you ostracised at all by the base, or did they embrace your task?
I can't remember the doggy man who was down there, but he was very, very kind and helped me enormously. Initially, a lot of reaction against it, but when you kind of went through it and logically, and at the end of the day, it was almost his decisions as to which dogs were kept and which dogs weren't put down, because he knew the dogs far better than me. I did. Okay. There might have been one or two. We said, look, come on, I think we ought to go for this. So it was done by mutual consent at the
so end. So to a certain extent, they were self-selecting?
Yeah, almost, yes. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
What happened to the carcasses?
Oh, just lobbed into sea.
Okay. It was 70.
I'm afraid, yeah, in those days we were, you know, completely different to now.
The dogs that were selected to come out of Halley Bay, well, how did they get to Stonington? Were they flown?
No. The first plane actually flew from Marguerite Bay to Stonington when I was there. Brooks of Vivian Fox. No, they went on the ship.
And did you actually witness those first flights?
Yes, yeah.
I was talking to Barry Peters last week about those first flights, and he was describing the attempts to take off again from Halley Bay. Had you got to Halley Bay by plane or by boat?
Boat.
Oh, I see, right. Okay.
Yeah, and then Sir Vivian Fuchs flew in, and we went down to his old base at Shackleton for a jolly, and he came out. Did he come out with us? Yes, he came out with us on the ship.
Okay. I usually ask this question later on, but as you brought him up, let's talk about him now. What did he make of him, Sir Vivian Fuchs?
I got in tremendously well. I thought he was a lovely man, but he was very much the old style. Bass was his pigeon. I'd met him at Cambridge. One of the things probably pushed me a little bit further when I was a student at Cambridge into joining Bass. Went to a couple of lectures he'd given, and they were tremendous, wonderful. Very, very friendly guy. He'd always be down and talk to us, and a very easy person to talk to.
Was he good with the troops?
Yeah, whole first class. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
So let's talk a bit more about the dogs, apart from just putting them down, which of course is, we have to talk about that, but let's talk about the more positive side of dog management with you. I'll talk about your dog management paper in the second half of the interview in some detail, if I may. But I'm just interested in the way you actually controlled or managed the breeding of the dogs, because presumably that was, as you were the vet, you were in charge of the breeding plans at Stonington that winter.
Yeah, that Andrew Bellars had found two things, haemophilia, which is a bleeding condition, and entropion, interning islet. If you go back, the first vet who went there was Mike Godsell, and the concern then was that, and which was the tie-up to the Cambridge Veterinary School, was that there was a neurological condition in the dogs. And a guy called Tony Palmer, who is a neurologist at the vet school in Cambridge, lived next door to Sir Vivian Fuchs in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And that was the connection. So talking over the garden wall, do you know a vet who's prepared to go out and sort out this neurological condition? Mike Godsell was a house surgeon at Cambridge, and he went out, and it turned out not to be a neurological condition. It turned out to be an arthritis of the hips and the shoulders. So 2 years later, Andrew Bellars went out with an X-ray machine to see if these dogs had got a condition called hip dysplasia, which is a hereditary condition, very, very common in many domestic breeds. So if it was, and that leads to arthritis. So if it was a hereditary condition, they've got to do something about it fairly dramatically. His X-rays proved that it wasn't. But in the process, he also found haemophilia and entropion. Now, haemophilia, a bleeding condition, as in humans, almost self-limiting because they die fairly quickly. Entropion, interning islet, is much, much more serious. And most of the breeding programs to try and outcross to make sure that these two conditions didn't survive any longer.
Were they a result of inbreeding?
Probably. I mean, they tried to. There is this massive Bellars, family tree that is extremely complicated. So you could see some lines have got it. Now, whether they originally came from inbreeding or not is difficult to know.
I'm seeing Andy Bellars in a couple of months' time.
Oh, right. Great guy.
I'll be able to ask him about that.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering whether you had to be very careful about who mated who to avoid, because it's a small number of dogs in a control, in a confined space, if you like, or ring fence, aren't they? So did you have to be very selective about who was allowed to breed with who?
Yes, yes. You obviously got a lot of mismatings going on. But there, in those days, there is a product, or was a product, which would prevent that. Hmm. Estrogen. So you could jab them with estrogen to make sure they didn't remain fertile.
Go the term.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was reading about dog contraceptives, is that right? You
were? Yes, we took it down. I took it down to a product called Perlutex, which was then a brand new product. Didn't go down very well with many people. Many of the drivers didn't like the idea. There was a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek prestige of having a dog in season. Put the dog in front and your dogs will pull their bloody hearts out. So, as long
put the
as
bitch
you,
in front, you mean.
Oh, sorry?
Put the bitch in front.
Butch in front, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you could control the bitch, it was a very good way of you driving your dogs.
You were trying to avoid bitches pupping whilst they were on field work?
Yes.
So tell me about how you managed that.
Oh, that was purely trying. If you knew, depending on when they go back, if you're on base, if a bitch was in season, she went into a hut, into a pen,
yeah,
to try and keep away from the dogs. Didn't always work. I know one time that we had a hell of a snowstorm and the dogs just walked over the top. but, you know, so you did control it like that. In the field, it's very difficult control, and you did get some mismating. I was trying to use the contraceptive as much as possible in the field. But otherwise, if you knew a bitch was going to pup, you either flew her out or she didn't go into the field to begin with. You know, depending on when she was going to pup.
So not all the mating was man-managed. Some of it took place naturally.
Oh, gosh, yes, yes, yes. And then if the pups were born, depending if you wanted the litter on, I'm afraid the pups were destroyed at birth, if you didn't want them.
So you were particularly culling the females at birth, is that right?
Yes, because we proportionally wanted... the ideal team was said to be seven male dogs and two bitches. Ideally, you'd like nine male dogs, full stop.
Right.
And there was a ladies' team.
Yes.
Of entirely females.
How was that compared to the men's team?
There were 10 of them. So you had one extra to provide the extra weight.
Right. Okay. So again, you're playing with human emotions here, aren't you? If all these lovely furry little puppies appear and then the vet comes along with a needle.
Oh, the vet didn't come. No. The doggy drivers and the doggy men and people put them down.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Don't forget, I'm the only vet who's been there for the winter, for the whole year. So these guys are hardened to it themselves, unfortunately.
Right, okay. Thank you very much for clearing that up. How were the leaders chosen? What sort of process, by what process did the leading dog get chosen? Or do they choose themselves again?
Choose themselves, again, going backwards. A puppy would come into the field at about a year old. Inevitably was a husky pulls with no idea of direction, but naturally pulls. So the puppy, I had a puppy called Jockalai, came into the field, and he was initially attached to the cow catcher right on the front of the sledge. So if he slacks at all, gets a bash up the backside with the sledge, which makes him pull. Once he's learnt to pull consistently, he goes further up the team. And depending if he's intelligent or not, he either stops at the back or he goes forward. And I always talk at WI meetings and things like that. You know, your good old Irish navvy stayed at the back, pulled all day, hadn't a clue why he was pulling, but he pulled all day. But the Cambridge graduate slowly worked his way forward because he was intelligent. But you've got to have someone. So when I took over my team, I had a dog called Clive, who was my leader, but he would not lead for me.
This is the Gaels, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't lead for me, but his brother Beast would. And it's just, why wouldn't he? I've no idea.
But Jockalai became lead with the Gaels.
Yes. Didn't he? Yes.
So was that a natural process? Or?
Yeah, he was intelligent. He got on very well. I got on tremendously well with him. So you get that relationship. And as long as he's got... The difficulty of the leader, he's got to go out in front by himself. And you've got to have control. And we don't use whips or reins or anything like that. So he's got to go out there and respond to you.
So what are the qualities then of a good leader? What are the leadership qualities, shall we say, that you're looking for?
Again, we don't have king dogs as they did in the past. It's not the biggest, strongest, heftiest, going to beat everybody else up. It's an intelligent dog who will go out by himself and steer forward. I loved Beast when I was working with him, especially in the summer when the crevasses were bad, because Beast was, like me, terrified of crevasses. He would go out front, but immediately you knew you were in crevasse country because his ears would go down, his tail would go down, and he would start looking frightened. And now I know that sounds stupid to someone who doesn't know dogs, but you know, you knew straight away that you were in a crevasse area. But there are times when he wasn't particularly brave. So there are a lot of times when we were into icy conditions, he would think it was a crevasse and he wouldn't go forward. Whereas Jockalai was still young enough and stupid enough to go forward properly because he hadn't got the experience of what might go wrong. But as long as he was prepared to pull the team forward, you're right. One of the major problems is on a traverse, very easy for the dogs to swing round and go down the hill. But if you want to keep going, you've got to have a dog that's big enough and brave enough to literally put its claws in and keep pulling on a straight line across the traverse.
And Jockalai was that dog for you?
He was a big dog, and yes, he was prepared to do that. Yeah. But Jockalai only became a leader in the last few months. I mean, Beast was my leader for most of the time.
Did Beast resent not being at the front anymore?
No, I don't think so. No, I think he was much happier. He was always in the first pair anyway with a dog called Debbie, who my daughter's named after. I think Beast was, quite frankly, much, much happier as second.
So the dogs kind of accepted their place in the ladder of...
Very much so, yes. I think so. It was considered a huge punishment if they came back. And if they were being naughty, you'd put them on the cow catcher or very, very close to the back. And they knew that was a punishment.
They?
And they knew if they didn't pull their hearts out, they were going to get a bish up the backside from this thing. So you put them there for half an hour, and total change of attitude. And the next stop, you put them back forward and they did pull their hearts out again.
I was surprised to learn that you actually discipline the dogs physically. I mean, I've heard about using a thumper to break up a fight.
Yes.
But the thumper was used in more ways than one.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Can you talk a bit about that for me?
The thumper is a rope of about, I've got mine here still actually, 2 foot long, that's fairly thick. And you beat them with that, and only beat them on the back legs. You should only beat them on the back legs as punishment. These dogs are enormous, enormous dogs. And it was... Often you'd see someone, that the driver would be exhausted from beating the dog. And so, you know, get back, you beggar, and that was it. And the dog would just jump up and lick the bloke's face. And I don't think it had any effect on the dogs at all, but the drivers felt better for it.
So it didn't hurt them?
I don't think so. And you know, where we started from the word go, when I actually wrote that article and suggested there that we were nothing like as cruel as they had been, and I got a severe letter from Andrew Croft, which was I was pleased he wrote it, saying that they were so much more isolated, they had to be much more severe. And the things they were doing was completely different to what we were doing.
That was in what period?
30s, 35, something like that. In the North Pole, in the Arctic.
The other thing which surprised me, talking about your... I've been reading your Gales Dog Team report, amongst other documents that Bass gave me. And I was surprised that the lead dog could get bored.
Depends where you are, yeah, and they can easily get bored. If I'm just reading, because of this interview, I'm rereading my notes, and it's my diaries, and it's wonderful. But if you get what we call bondu bashing, you're on the peninsula, in the middle of the peninsula. If you're on either side, you've got the glaciers, and the scenery is beautiful. But if you go to the top of the peninsula and you stay on the plateau, it's undulating, and there is absolutely nothing to see. And so they just plod on with nothing to look at. If what you do, you alternate. So I spent my whole year with a guy called Peter Butler. So one day I'd be in front, next day he would be in front. The second team follow easily. They've got something to look at. The one in front, especially the lead dog, got nothing but nothing to look at.
Just snow.
Just snow. And one of the famous occasions, we were after a nun attack in the middle of nowhere, actually. And it was just slightly undulating. And then suddenly, after about 3 days, I could see this nun attack. So I was yelling and screaming at the dog. Look, it's there. They scream on for a mile and a half. And then suddenly, what the hell is he talking about? And you realise that I'm 6 foot two, so my eyes are 10 foot, 5 foot ten. And their eyes are 1 foot six, something like that. And it was about another 20 miles before they saw this. And they came over. And then by that time, I'd gone to sleep. I'd been seeing this thing for ages. And suddenly the dog just... took off completely, because it's the first time they'd actually seen something in front of them for about 3 days.
Did you ever find yourself singing to your dogs?
To me, it was a complete and utter disaster. Yes, you sang to them. They usually turned around and thought, what the hell's that row? talking to them the whole time, you just talked complete gibberish. But yes, I did try singing. It didn't work for me. Tried whistling. That didn't work for me either.
But men did sing, did they?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Tell me about the commands, because there seem to be some standard commands that nearly everybody in that particular era in the Antarctic used, and then people had their own personal commands as well.
Well, yes, but that's only... basically, it was left, start, stop, left, right. Those are the basic commands. The rest of the time, yeah, you talk to them. No different to talking to your own dog in a domestic area, you know, like here. So, come on, lads, come on, keep going, come on, speed up, slow down, whatever it might be, just chatting to them. But those weren't the commands, really. They were just chatting, if you like.
Were the commands standardised across all the bases?
Yes, yes. Very definitely, because the dogs were moved around between the bases, so they all had to have the same commands.
Okay. There was some friction, I believe, with London about how much sledging you might be allowed to do. I gather there was a papal bull from Vivian Fuchs about this.
That happened. Winter sledging is a bit of a waste of time. You don't get a lot of work done because the daylight is so short. But it's extremely safe because it's so cold that most of the crevasses are frozen over. Bridges are good. So we arrived on base in January time-ish, midwinter's June. March we arrived. So you haven't got long before you've actually got yourself established, probably the end of March. We went out in April and were out there for 6 weeks. Frankly, didn't get a lot of work done. But it did give you a vast amount of experience of dogs and sledging. And then when we were there, then, yes, the command came that we weren't allowed to do winter sledging any longer.
Did he ever get to the bottom of that decision?
Who? Did we or they?
Anybody.
No, it was just a decision that came down. I don't know what happened the following year about that, because, of course, the following year, Sir Vivian Fuchs had retired and... Dick Laws had taken over. I'm not quite sure what happened the following year. But to me, it was inevitable. We'd all gone down. We were all doggy mad. We all wanted a sledge. We weren't going to get any work done on base anyway. There's no work to do, so you might as well go out and sledge from our point of view, even if you've got a little bit of work done. But it was the experience that was important to us.
But you never realised, you never understood why Fuchs has stopped. Basically, he restricted sledging to 25 miles radius of the base,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, yes.
But he never worked out why.
No, because no one, in our time, no one had, was killed or died, or there were no accidents.
The base report, base commander's report on that, is pretty damning, really. This late signal constituted a significant blow to morale of personnel, yes, keyed up to recommence field work in an effort to recoup lost working time. And they were all ready to go, and then the memo arrived.
Yes, that's right.
What was the reaction on the base?
Oh, doom and gloom completely. Because, I mean, that, you know, we were there to drive dogs and get some work done.
Conversely, the following summer, you did an extortionate amount of sledging, 137 days, nearly 1,400 miles.
Yes, but we were actually behind, about 2 years before with the guys, you know, the real peak when people were doing a couple of thousand miles. Yes, we did.
Tell me about that summer trip.
That was brilliant. I mean, you know, I went to the Antarctic, basically. We were, and that's where it was. Dogs are gone now, but that's where it changed completely. That in that we had the long trip fairly early on in pretty awful weather in order to get to our work area, whereas the year after us, they were all flown down straight away. Mm. So did they do any more work? I'm not sure if they did. Quite honestly, because we had to wait for the planes to come, whereas we worked our way down. So yeah, it's amazing how many lie-ups we did, not doing anything because of bad weather. But it was a wonderful, wonderful trip seeing at the Antarctic in its worst condition possible and the best conditions possible. So lots of very cold weather, some lousy winds. We were down on the east coast of the peninsula, where you get the east coast mank, which is the fog that rolls in from the Weddell seaside. Don't get a lot. And then we went across the west side, which was spectacularly beautiful. Very hot, clear, sunny days, and very good sledging.
Who was the scientist who was with you?
Peter Butler.
And he was doing?
Geophysics.
Okay. So, do you want to elaborate on that slightly? Can you tell me more about what exactly he was doing?
No, because I've never understood it all while I was there. He basically tried to tell me that the geologists were looking at the rock structures that they could see, and he was looking at the rock structures that you couldn't see.
Right.
Now, beyond that, although we obviously spent an awful long time talking about it, I never got any further as to what the heck was going on there. I spent all year with him, but I should have understood a bit more than that.
How was it for you? When you're away from base that length of time, 137 days, contact with any other form of life is quite limited, isn't it, really? So did you start... Was there any change of psychology inside you that you began to feel more isolated, or you began...
You never felt isolated. It was almost the opposite way around, actually, because you can get away from Peter. Not that I wanted to, don't get wrong. Mm. But, you know, you couldn't talk to anybody else. It was just the two. So it was, is that isolation or not? And one of the wonderful things at Stonington Base, there were 14 of us there that year, and you knew if you had a row with somebody, you'd suddenly say, you know, where's Bob gone? He's gone to see the dogs. And nothing was said. And the guy would go up, or I'd go up to talk to the dogs. They always responded. They always knew you were right. And you came back half an hour later in a much, much better frame of mind. So on base, even though there were 40 of us, you could feel very, very, I just want to get away. Whereas once you're sledging, you can't get away at all. I mean, you could go out, but outside was 10, 20 yards away.
Mm. So how did that change the dynamic of the relationship with suddenly the person you were with was one of 40, now you're just a duo for...
Yeah, you've got to get on with them. You've got to, like any relationship, you've got to, put up with your differences when they occur. And either, did Peter and I have any blazing rows? I don't think so. We had plenty of disagreements. But they're always sorted out. You've got to sort them out. You've got no choice not to. The first month or so, there were four of us together working our way down. And then after that, yes, we met up with other sledges on two or three occasions, but otherwise we were on our own the whole time.
How did the gales rise to the occasion for this long trip?
You always think you've got the best team in the world. Everyone does, but unfortunately the Spartans, which was... Peter had been down once before, and he had a lot of experience, and I'm grateful for that huge experience that he had. And his team seemed to be up my backside most of the time. So in other words, performing better than mine, and he seemed to drive them better than mine, but no, there are days when I was driving better than him, and I think it's like anything. At the end of the day, who was the better team? I would definitely say mine was, and Peter would definitely say his were. I think we were fairly compatible together, actually.
And how was that? How was that frontier when he got back and stepped over the threshold of the hut again after being away for so long?
I came out of the field early. Twiggy, who was our radio operator, went in. So I came out about 3 weeks early in order to go... one of the things I wanted to do was actually do the sealing. In those days, we were killing 400 or 500 seal, Weddell seal, and crab eaters. And there was a programme that I wanted to do for London Zoo, looking at pathological material in what were thought to be perfectly normal seal. So I was very keen to get back in time, and did in the event. So it was a bit different from all the other sledges who tended to come in at the same time. And there was a very big change on base, whereas when I got back, there were four of us there, and then it slowly built up and built up again back to the full complement.
Tell me more about this, what you were doing for London Zoo, because in the diary, the base diary for the 13th of August 73, they talk about you measuring seals. Is that what you were doing?
No, that was part of Fuchs, Laws's programme. What we were trying to do, I didn't have a problem with killing a large number of seal. I'm told that there was something like 125 million crab eaters, and it's the largest population of primates, of mammals on the world, except for humans. So the numbers we were taking was immaterial. But I did feel that if we were going to kill them, we ought to try and get as much information as possible. And Laws was doing a lot of work on this. So we were trying, we were measuring them, we were collecting either the testicles or the ovaries, and we were collecting the second molar tooth to age them. Now, it was a complete fluke, but I was extremely glad that... And most people just want to get the sealing done, finished, job done, and they can go and have a good beer afterwards. And I, because I was kind of in charge, in inverted commas, of it, I said to everyone before we started, look, we wanted to get all this done, please. And I then showed them how I felt it should be done from my experience of post-mortem animals. So instead of actually taking just the one tooth out, we took the whole jaw out, which was a lot quicker than just trying to... So that sped things up. The testicle in seals is internal, so it can be quite difficult to find. Ovaries are not a problem, measuring is not a problem. But what was important from the dog point of view is that we go cleanly through... Well, no, you go through the mandibular symphysis, that the two jaw bones are not complete. There's a gap between it. So if you go through there, you get the jawbone easily. You can then slice through the brisket, the chest, extremely easy if you go to the right place, which most people hadn't realised because there's a bit of cartilage there. And you must go through the pelvis at the other end because a lot of times they'd left a small amount of the rectum in the animal, and that would then go off when it thawed out years later. So you were wasting a lot of meat from the dog's point of view. So I showed people how they should do it, straight through, and it actually took 27 seconds to collect the material and to gut it. And as a result of that, I can't remember the seaman's name, but one of the seamen who'd been on the ship for years and years and years had never seen this technique, thought that was unbelievable, and he was my shadow for the next 3 days, and he just stayed there, sharpened knives. And every time I put my hand up, there was a knife that was so incredibly sharp. And it all, yeah, because of that, we got, I can't remember, of the 500 seals we killed, we got samples from 400 and something, far higher than they'd ever had before. And Dick Laws was thrilled and I was thrilled. So at the same time, I said to anybody who was doing it, because what we were doing, we were landing about 8 seal at a time. So I wasn't doing all the gutting, plenty of other people were doing the gutting. So if you ever see anything that looks unusual, please stop and shout. And as a result of that, we were collecting... First of all, we were collecting perfectly normal tissue to send to London Zoo. So they've got a library, basically, of normal wild seal tissue. And then we were looking at anything abnormal was sent to them as well.
This would be disease or...?
Yes.
Yeah.
What looked like disease at the time... Oh, that was material that's gone to London Zoo. I've had no more to do with it at all.
How did that come about? Did they approach you?
Yes, I was approached on that one. Because of the ringworm, I'd seen a guy whose name I can't remember, at London Zoo, who was then one of the big experts on ringworm in animals, and I'd spoken to him, so presumably through that contact. Just before I left the Antarctic, quite a few people had contacted me and asked me if I could get material from various things. It was such a strange thing for a vet to go down, frankly.
Yes, yeah, a unique opportunity.
Yes, yeah. And from Bass's point of view, obviously, the more material we can get for other people or anything, it's
prestige.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Did I read right that you actually did some sealing from the Bisco?
Yes, that was. Yeah, sorry, that was all from the Bisco.
Oh, right, OK.
Yes. Yeah.
Was that a standard practice? Or was that just one of those lucky... You don't know?
I think that was... I don't know. I think it was a standard practice, actually.
When the boat was in, you took the opportunity to go and get fetched long
distance. Oh, no. It was part of their schedule. They knew they needed so many seals at Stonington, so it was, part of their the programme it had
been
done.
So they were bringing them in for you?
No, they came in, they had a full complement, they had quite a few people who were on their way out of the Antarctic on the ship, and then, they would go into... We'd go into a field somewhere close by, then the small boats would go onto the ice floes, kill them, and then they'd drag them at about 8 at a time.
So it was a specific hunting trip and you were...
Totally,
were you
absolutely
in charge?
I was in charge of not the slaughtering itself, if you like, but just the management of the carcasses, if you like. Yes.
Mm. And would you regard that to be humane killing?
Yes, I didn't see a problem with it.
Okay, right.
There are one or two other little things that I didn't quite follow from the report because I haven't come across them before. So tell me about outdoor chess.
Outdoor chess?
Yes. Moving stores around.
That was just the usual sort of thing. Sorry, have I mentioned things like that?
No, but the base. Report does.
When we arrived, you've got Stonington base itself, hut. You had the old American hut, which was then used as a sledging workshop, and you had Fuchs's old hut, which had mostly burnt down, and you had another area. Which all Antarctic bases have a refuge in case there is a fire. So we've landed up by moving an awful lot of stores around and then at the end of the day set fire to the rest of Fuchs's base just to tidy it up. So, yes, there was a lot of moving of stores from backwards and forwards and God knows where.
I also got the impression you had to do quite a lot of cleaning up of Stonington area. I
think yes.
Elaborate on that as well? I think you went and did some work on the Finronny base, didn't you?
Yes. Because it was falling down, I think that was one of the directives that Steve, the base commander, had to try and tidy the place up, and we were proud of the job that we did at the end of the day. It was because there was a huge thaw had gone on around that time the year before, revealing all this rubbish around the place. Hmm. Yeah, we spent a lot of time cleaning it up and basically burning it. I'm politically incorrect now, so big black fires going on the whole time.
There's an observation here which I'll put to you and see what you think. There seem to have been frictions with the directorship of Bass which affected the whole base. The impression is also given that Bay C had become very sloppy in the past and dirty through weak leadership and that the base commander had been put in to clean the place up. Certainly much work and effort was extended that year in cleaning up the site, inventorying the stores properly and putting in a proper indent system. Is that a fair summary?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And we were one of the comments. I mean, I can clearly remember when I arrived, and the comments in my diary was the pace was absolutely disgusting when we arrived. It's very difficult when we're all doggy, when you're feeding seal during the winter. Not in every person is feeding it, but you do your dogs were fed every other day. There's 14 of us, so you kind of get involved, a couple of people doing it. So, you know, once a fortnight, you're involved in handling this pretty revolting seal meat. If it's frozen, that's fine, but often it's not quite frozen, so it's greasy and revolting. The dogs are greasy and revolting. And we all smelt, and we were allowed a shower once a fortnight. So it was all pretty disgusting, but to me, there was no reason that we should... The whole hut was like that, and it was very greasy and dirty when we arrived, and we were very, very proud of the fact how clean it was when we left. Steve was a wonderful base commander.
Steve.
Fantastic. Steve Wormald.
Right. So this was not resentful work then? This is work he wanted to do?
No,
being denied the chance of sledging in the winter, this was okay work?
Most of it. It wasn't necessarily in the winter that we were doing. We were doing this before the ship came back, to before relief. We were doing it the whole time. No, it was totally unrelated. Yeah, we were fairly proud of the base that we had.
Does it raise morale to be clean and tidy and...
Yes, I think so.
...shaved and...
Yes. Oh, we weren't shaved.
No. That was one step too far, perhaps.
Absolutely, definitely. And sadly, because of the water situation, it was literally... we had a 5-gallon oil drum with a garden sprinkler underneath, and you're entitled that when you're on Gashand, which was the day before you did cook. So that's once a fortnight. So once a fortnight, 5 gallons of water. And that was it. So we were all pretty revolting and smelly. But every week we had, exactly as on the ship, you had a scrub out. And the place was scrubbed out and made, I won't say spotless, but extremely clean.
Underarm deodorant spray?
Didn't exist in those days.
Roll-on spray? Roll-on underarm deodorant?
Didn't exist in those days, did it?
I think as a teenager I seem to remember dallying with it.
I can't remember, I don't think so.
So it wasn't bothered with then?
No.
No, okay. It never made it to Stonington?
Absolutely not. No. Okay. Definitely not.
Did you, when you got together in the bar at the end of the day, what sort of conversations did you have? There's a reference again in the base commander's report to spending some evening sorting out the world problems around the bar. Was that a regular occurrence? Or was that...
Yes and no. how much contact did we have with the BBC and the World Service? Not a lot.
Did you want it?
Yes, in a way that, I mean, the two things were happening. The Vietnam War was coming to an end, and more important was the troubles in Northern Ireland. We had a guy from Northern Ireland, Eric Lawther, with us, mm-hmm. whose brother was in trouble in Northern Ireland. Right. So that was something that we did discuss quite a lot. And then towards the end, we had this winter of discontent with the Edward Heath government and all the strikes were going on. So we weren't quite sure what world we were going back to. But then you get all these weird things that have you heard or haven't you heard? And one of the things had Barbara Streisand died. And this argument went backwards and forwards for months upon ends because someone maintained they'd heard it on the World Service and someone maintained, don't be so stupid, or, you know, but because you get so little news. And in those days, I mean, don't forget, it was long before internet or anything like that, we had contact with Adelaide Island for 1 hour a day or something like that. But otherwise, we were virtually on our own. It's such a different world now. It's difficult to make people understand what it was like.
Some of the BFIDs I talked to actually quite revelled in the fact they had no idea what was going on.
Oh, absolutely.
On the rest of the planet.
Yes.
Was that what
did it matter?
Where did you stand on that?
Oh, it didn't matter because we can't do anything. Couldn't do anything about it. Mm. I think that's the great thing. Even in this country, you know, how many people vote on the basis, well, my vote won't make a difference. But out there, when there's absolutely nothing that you can do about it, the ship's coming back in a year's time, so you can't get out early, go and help your brother or whatever because he's in trouble in Northern Ireland or whatever it might be, there's nothing you can do.
So did the impotence lead to frustration or to a sort of zen-like state?
Oh, zen-like, because it didn't affect us, so we're not really bothered. We were much more concerned that a dog was pulling well or not pulling well or a bitch was in heat. And the whole life, 90% of our conversation was dogs.
Really?
It might sound incredibly sad, but that was the case.
Sounds incredibly realistic. you had a Land Rover on the base, I was
No, that only arrived on at release.
Well, it was still there.
It was, oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
How effective? So did you ever find out how effective it was?
Well, yeah. John Newman, who was our mechanic, he thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. We always thought the dogs pulled a hell of a lot more than the Land Rover could, but it was fun to have it. I'm not quite sure how effective it was, quite frankly.
I'm just staggered it got there. I mean, well, I know.
Came off the scow, yes.
Yeah, but I'm just amazed at anybody should think of taking a Land Rover.
Well, that's a problem because the terrain at Stonington stands not that high up, but it's a beach, a very, very large stony beach. So, quite frankly, it wasn't the best thing to be carrying goods up and down. Fid Power, which is carrying and or dogs, are far more effective, quite frankly.
So was this would you say this was a planned experiment or did you just...
I've no idea who sent it down or why it came.
Tell me about your time with the Skidoos.
Me? I have very little time with Skidoos. Did we have any on base? We had them at Halley Bay.
There's talk of them being used to round up the dogs. The Skidoo Rodeo.
To round up a... Well, no, that would be only the odd one that got loose. No, I don't remember that too much, actually.
OK, that's fine.
Did we have one on base? Yeah, we probably did.
I have to try these things and see. But, again, on the same basis, you may not know what this means. What was the Steptoe game? All right.
No, nope, can't help what that one is.
No, that's fine. That's,
a shame.
Fine. No.
Let me know what it is when you
get
it.
Yeah.
And I'll send it on, of course, that
again,
one. Yeah.
It's in the base commander's report. But because it obviously is such a well-known phrase at the time, he doesn't expand on it.
Well, this is the problem. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you have to convert your veterinary skills to human doctoring skills at all?
Yes, and dentistry.
I think you had to help Dave Burkitt at some point, Father Burkitt.
Yeah, well, there were quite a few people that needed stitching up. And then I think it was Steve Yates got malaria. Someone got malaria down there. He'd been in Africa before. But no, there was quite a bit of stitching people up, not much more than that.
Nothing too serious?
No.
Didn't Dave Burkitt have an injury that was difficult to diagnose?
He did. He fell. He'd coming back from the winter trip, he had a terrible accident. he was coming off the soda bread. He did, and I remember talking to the doctor at Adelaide about it. I'm going to blank on that one now. He's perfectly right, because I saw Dave not that long ago.
Oh, so, yes. He's recovered.
Yes.
Let's take a break, we may, and then we'll come back and spend some more time talking about your publications.